Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Hello and welcome back to Tennis Unfiltered with me, James Gray of iNews.co.uk and the iNewspaper. I've got George Belshaw and Calvin Betton here for our weekly look back at everything that's been going on in the tennis world. I've got a lot to get through this week because we are a couple of days late. I apologise for that and the slight croak in my voice. I can only blame 4 days in Krakow and meeting the love of my life. That didn't happen in Krakow. I met her some years ago and I am marrying her later this year, hence 4 days in Krakow. We do swap shirts on this podcast, I should note, but we do wait until afterwards to ask each other for the shirt. George, I really like this that you're wearing, and I'm worried that we might not get a chance to swap. So just so you know, I'll ask you afterwards.
Not to be too gross and graphic, James, but I'm bolting off to play football straight after this record because we've moved into my Wednesday schedule rather than my Monday. And I realised when I got home from work that I totally forgot to wash my kit. So I'm actually wearing a really sweaty shirt from last week that's been sat in my washing basket. So I don't think you actually want this shirt.
Presumably, when Pedro Cachin asked Rafa Nadal for his shirt, Rafa Nadal sweats more than maybe anyone I've ever seen. So that's the thing with a match-worn shirt, right? It's going to be sweaty.
And you wouldn't want the shorts, would you, where he's putting that?
Have you not seen that video of a rugby league player who takes his shorts off pitch side and chucks them into the crowd? And the woman, like, catches them and then just has an enormous sniff of them. It's horrible. Yeah, it's not nice. Rugby league's a weird sport. It's the North, Calvin. I mean, although you're not really in rugby league territory, are you?
Wakefield very much is, and I'm the Barnsley side. I'm the Wakefield side of Barnsley, but it's mainly the M62 corridor, isn't it? Castleford to, well, Hull to Castleford to Widnes and St Helens and all that.
Yeah. It must be the most concentrated professional sport, apart from like Pelota or...
Well, every city that plays it is on the M62.
London, the London Broncos.
Oh, London, I didn't
and
even realise London.
And the Catalan on the M62.
The M62 has an extension to Catalonia.
You can get to Catalan quicker than you can some of the places on the M62, to be fair, if you're going on the M62.
Right, I'm going to start with a review because we've had a good one from Hey161178. Mr. and Mrs. 161178 must be very proud. Best tennis podcast. Love Calvin's music knowledge. Love the podcast, lads. After finding this podcast last year, I've gone back and listened to every episode. I mean, that is about 250. Fair play. Love the rants, love the bants, and general tennis content. Keep up the good work. As a tennis parent myself, I really love Calvin's views and openness on tennis. Calvin, what have you been listening to this week?
Well, I discovered I discovered a Solwax, I don't know, like mashup mix set of David Bowie, and it's all I've listened to for 3 days. It's absolutely amazing. If anyone can get it, it's like an hour long set, and you can get it on YouTube and Apple Music. I think it's from a few years back, but I'd not heard it. But it's unbelievably good.
We should make a Spotify playlist and have a Calvin song of the week and just put it in every week.
That's a good idea.
That's not the last
I'll check it out, Calvin.
I'm off Spotify. I ditched Spotify as a rights, sort of hand up to the musicians.
So yeah, rightly so.
I'm Apple Music now.
I bet. Do they pay more or better?
They do pay more, yeah. They pay quite a bit more. Yeah. Spotify are terrible. Spotify are the worst. Yeah, Spotify and YouTube are the two worst, I think.
I see. Right, well, thanks for your rating and review. You can leave them wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify. You can leave a review on Spotify because not many people know this. But you can.
Welcome to Spotify listeners.
Yeah, welcome to Spotify listeners, you scumbags, single-handedly tearing down the music industry. Just don't listen to any music on there, it's fine.
Also, are we getting torn down by Spotify? Should we be up in arms as well? Or are we...
No. In fact, our hosting website is owned by Spotify, so we probably can't slag them off. This podcast's
fine, I think. Podcast's fine. It's like it's the musician, it's the streaming that they don't.
Oh, damn right. For. Yeah, we get paid a fortune, so.
You guys never see all of that.
It all comes into a bank account somewhere. Right. Let's crack on with some listener questions, mostly for Calvin, as you will not be surprised to hear. But one of them does correct my French, so I'm going to start with that one. Vince from Montpellier says, although it makes a lot of sense that the tennis podcast would be called No Tenderloin, filet is also French for net, as I was trying to translate a French podcast called No Filet, or Non Filet, which is also mentioned in a review of us. Thanks for that, and you're not the only one, Vince, so... proves that I haven't spoken French in a long, long time.
Was it a negative review from a very upset French?
No, it was someone who liked it and said it's the best English language podcast. But if you do speak French, then I think it was called Non Filet, is a good one to listen to. Anyway, Vince also has a question. Says, really enjoy Calvin on players' physical shortcomings. Who would he say has the perfect physical qualities for tennis? Is it Nadal, Djokovic, Federer? I heard before that Auger Aliassime has the perfect body for tennis. So why does he struggle so much on court? Thanks for all the great shows. Thanks for the question, Vince. Who's the perfect physical specimen for tennis, Calvin?
I'd say Felix comes pretty close to what, if you were going to make one like from scratch, that would what you would aim for. But he has, you know, why he falls short. There's obviously some mental shortcomings and some technical issues that I've highlighted on here before. But it's difficult to say like what is the perfect one. You know, there are probably 3 or 4 different models. If you're going to be a serve and volleyer, like, you know, Pete Sampras was about the perfect physical model for it. He was extremely athletic. I think he was about 6'2". And, you know, and then that was kind of that. But then you get like Djokovic, who's probably less explosive as such, but has this otherworldly flexibility that allows him to do what he does. So I guess it depends on what kind of style you're going to play, but generally it was seen as, I remember when he came through it, when he won the US Open at 16, Felix Auger-Aliassime was people were saying this is the best athlete we've ever had in tennis. Mm-hmm. Some people say that it was Monfils, but like I highlighted the other week, it's the same with anything with physicality, that if you have so much in one area, it usually means there's a drawback in another area. Mm-hmm. Like you can be 6'8" and have an absolute cannon of a serve, but it probably means you can't move very well. You can move very well at 5'8", but you'll struggle with serve. So it's a balance, isn't it? But and I think also with Felix, something that I've noticed recently is that because of he's obviously so muscular. There's a little bit of stiffness about his strokes as well that I don't think helps him. He struggles when, if you're going to have great tennis strokes and great technique, you want muscle relaxation. And he doesn't have a whole great amount of that. So maybe that holds him back in that regard.
Mm. I think what's nice about tennis as well is that, like, surprisingly, even in the modern game, there are lots of different types of physiques out there. You know, guys can differ and women slightly. Maybe the women's game is a little bit different, although actually thinking about it, there are plenty of women out there you wouldn't expect to you know, you look at them. You watch Elena Ostapenko, for example. You're like, you wouldn't expect her to be a professional tennis player if she saw her walking around the street, but she is. And yet you compare her to like Maria Sakkari or whoever it might be, and they're very different looking players. But I even think about like Serena throughout her career, you know, in the latter years, she was a much bigger and more muscular and probably heavier athlete. And she didn't move very well, but she was so powerful that it almost didn't matter. Whereas actually, you go back and watch like US Opens from the early 2000s, she was lithe and fast and, you know, not that, well, quite powerful still, but not as powerful, moved so much better.
Yeah, I think as well, like when we got into Talent ID in Britain in particular with young tennis players, that sort of, we started thinking we could identify them at 6 years old. This was about 10 or 12 years ago, and it was always kind of what the LTA who ran the talent ID system, or the people who ran it for the LTA, became obsessed with was height. And there was this obsession with focus on like how tall of a kid's parents. And I remember going to a regional training session that I ran, but the players were selected, and the person who selected him I knew him and he's a friend of mine, but he's obsessed with height. And we had all these kids there who were tall and absolutely shit. And then like they couldn't run, like no offense to them. But, and I remember we had them warming up doing sprints. And I remember there was one of them in particular. And I said to the guy, I was like, what have you got this lad in for? And he was like, he's a phenomenal athlete. And I was like, he's maybe the slowest kid I've ever seen. I mean, he was outrageously tall. And his dad was like 6'8". And I think his mum was about 6'2". And I was like, and he was like, no, he's an unbelievable athlete. I'm like, he's so slow. Like, he can't run. What you mean is he's tall. And then that's where we just became, the talent ID now, I was thinking about it the other day, the talent ID's like gradings, what they had. And this was about 15 years ago, probably. Like now they just look so embarrassing knowing what we know now and what we tried to create. And the problem is when you do that, as I've said this many times before, that you don't know what tennis is going to look like. You can't identify a six-year-old today for to be a tennis player in 15 years' time, because you don't know what tennis is going to look like in 15 years' time. And I remember in the late 1990s, mid-late 1990s, we genuinely thought that tennis was just going to be populated by 6'6" serve bots. And that's what we were, that's what everyone was expecting. And it just never materialized. That never happened. And I don't think it ever will, to be honest.
I think also the talent ID stuff, when you look at where it's been successful, it's moving people of a certain archetype into sports that are quite, for want of a better phrase, low skill. So like yeah, cycling or bobsleigh.
Measurable sports. Right, yeah. That's what it is. I mean, and Alan Jones, who passed away a couple of weeks ago, I remember having a conversation with him about this, and we were in agreement on it that British tennis in particular has an obsession with trying to be like measurable sports, that yeah, cycling, rowing, athletics, that kind of thing, even to a lesser degree, because it's not a fully measurable sport, but cricket was similar as well, that you could get averages of, I mean, when Simon Timson came in, he thought you could predict if a player was going to be an England batsman by his averages at each age group and level and that kind of thing. But we've always tried that. And my position on talent ID has always been the same, that you can maybe identify the kids or the people that are not going to be tennis players, but you can't identify the ones who are. Like, and I think that may sound harsh, but if you bring 100 kids in front of me now and have them playing tennis, I can tell you the ones for certain that aren't going to be top 100 tennis players. Then that might be 40 of them. They're not going to be. I couldn't tell you which two are going to be. That's impossible.
But what age kids are we talking about there, Calvin?
Well, I mean, what they tend to do, talent ID now, is like 6 to 10, I'd say. But again, that's what makes it impossible.
Yeah. I was reading a thing the other day about how these pre-academies that football clubs run now, like where literally, you know, kids from the age of 4 are like in a database, you know, heights being tracked, speeds being tracked, all these things. It's incredible. And yeah, people bloom at different times. It's interesting to say you could pick the ones that maybe can't be, but
It's the same with anything with kids, though. You know, kids like things and then suddenly they don't. So you might get an 8-year-old who looks like he's got everything, and then he gets to 9 and decides he doesn't like tennis anymore. Mm. You can't do anything about that.
Right, another question, I think. Well, a comment, I suppose. I did say when we were talking about Muguruza the other time, the other week, that she was the only player to beat both Williamses in a slam final. A good point from Lorraine, who says, Justine Henin beat both Williams sisters on the way to the 2007 US Open title, and Martina Hingis beat both of them on the way to the 2001 Australian Open final, but lost to Capriati. Muguruza may even be the only player ever to beat Serena twice at the same slam, having beaten her in an early round 2014 French Open and then the final 2016. So I did say at the time, if you can think of people who have beaten both Williams sisters in a slam, it's not quite the same stat, but...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. This was the only person to beat each one of them in a final, in a Grand Slam final. Yeah. I was surprised, the only one I was surprised, well, there's a couple that I was surprised didn't, like Clijsters I thought might have... Henan I thought might have, and Hingis I thought might have, but apparently not.
It was a shame I was missing last week, James, because I could have reminisced of one of the highlights of my journalism career, which was that I got to interview Muguruza the day after her Wimbledon win.
Oh, wow.
For an hour. And it was,
for an hour?
Yeah. It was, I don't know how the hell it came about. Someone just reached out to me, I think, from IMG, and I got to do a big kind of splash with her. It was great. It was really... She was lovely.
What would you say was the most sort of interesting or compelling thing about that?
Oh, God. I can share the link with you. I think... to be honest, it was a quite refreshing interview from the perspective of it's quite rare you get that kind of long opportunity after someone's had such a huge kind of moment in their career. And just, I remember she sort of embraced my hands together when we sort of kind of came down. I was like, this is all very weird.
Probably hanging out her arms.
Why are you being so nice to me? I think that was sort of a kind of quite special moment you don't get very often in sport unless you're kind of part of that winning team already, to kind of really interact with someone that kind of close afterwards and kind of get their thoughts. I mean, really, she was just over the moon, and maybe Calvin would say she wasn't ready enough to move on to the next one, wasn't focused enough. She enjoyed winning Wimbledon too much for his liking. But
I think you're allowed to celebrate a final, aren't you, Calvin?
So.
You're allowed to celebrate winning a final?
Go final.
Right, next question comes from... from Adam, sorry, yes, on email. If you want to email us, by the way, it's tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. I was watching the final at the weekend between Sloane Stephens and Magda Linetti. With Stephens 6-1 and one love up, I assumed the match was going her way quickly and decided to go walk the dog instead. We've all been there. When I came back, Linetti had won the set 6-2. Even watching back the highlights, it was hard to identify exactly why or when the momentum shifted. Calvin, as a coach, how quickly do you notice that a momentum shift is happening in a match? Is there anything that players can do to try and deal with that situation?
I think it's more on feeling. There was once, somebody wrote a book about momentum in tennis a few years ago, and I read it, and there was nothing to take away from it, because it's kind of not a measurable quality. You just kind of know it's happening. I think it's more, there's moments, I always think there's moments in matches, and I'm not always correct in this, where if a player's winning and they get a chance to kill it off, then don't take it, that always worries me. And specifically, this was one where I was wrong yesterday. Luke and Skander were playing a match, and they were set up and a breakup, and they had, I think, love 40 for a double break. Didn't take it, went back to juice. And I said, I messaged Henry, who was texting me at the time, and I said, I could have done with that double break there. That concerns me, because the court started raining as well. Court got a bit wet, where you're more likely to get breaks, break back. In the end, they didn't lose another game. So I was kind of, it didn't sort of happen in that way. But there's always kind of situations, I think, where you can feel... If you miss, there's windows of opportunities to finish matches off. And if you keep missing those windows, then I think that usually results in a momentum change.
And if you do recognise it, there's almost an argument, no one talks to a pitcher when they're on a no-hitter in baseball. Is there, with some players, you must feel like you don't want to say anything because you might just set them off or make them realise that something's about to change. Is there much you can do? Or is there much the player can do?
I'm always mindful of that when my players are playing. If everything's going well, and I'll basically say nothing. There's no need for me to be there, little bits of encouragement, but I won't try and get involved if there's nothing. It's quite interesting. I don't know whether anyone saw it earlier on, that Carlo Ancelotti had a quote, which I kind of agree with and also don't. He said there's two types of coaches in the world. There's the coaches that do nothing and the coaches that spoil things. and then somebody made a good point that you can say that if you manage this Real Madrid team.
Yeah, exactly.
And somebody said it's a bit different when he was managing Everton and Napoli. to just say that he does nothing, but there is a bit of truth in that. It's not always a case of saying that the coach should that you're always micromanaging. I'm always wary really to never micromanage. I don't think any of my players would say that I'm a micromanager, but you do get some coaches who are a bit like that, who are who would get it. I mean, there's one, the classic example was, I know in American college tennis, they started allowing coaches to, the coaches can sit on the bench and they can coach in a change of ends. They then started allowing coaches to literally walk up to the players after every point if they chose.
Oh my God.
And the classic example was this, was a player who I know, he's from the same part of the world as me, and I kind of help him out with bits of advice now and then. I was watching one of his matches a couple of years ago, and the match started so that the coach came on just before the first point of the match, and this player was serving, and he had a word with him. And then the player served an ace, and then the coach came back on straight after. And I thought, like, what on earth have you got to add after the ace? Like what piece of tactical genius have, that needs to be said now? But you do get some coaches who just want to be involved all the time.
I can think of a few in professional tennis who might fall foul of that if they were allowed to walk onto court.
Yeah.
Thanks for your question very much, Adam. And I've got one more, which you pointed out from Twitter. We're at Unfilter Tennis on Twitter. I think this is directly at you, Calv Betton, from Avid Tennis Fan. Another one. It's such an unusual surname, Tennis Fan. I don't know if it's maybe Kazakh or Armenian. We'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the pod on Madrid doubles, especially Hassan Shelbai beating Dodik Krajicek, which was a pretty big upset for the books based on records. Calvin, you were worried, well, annoyed by the Madrid doubles format. How's it played out, and that result in particular?
I mean, I think yesterday the singles guys won the first couple yesterday. That was an absolute shocker result for Krajicek and Dodik, because they're a very good pair, obviously. And what's most bizarre of all about that was that Krajicek was a pretty decent singles player and Dodik was an excellent singles player in his day. And they've been in, you know, they're good on clay. I think they won the French Open last year. And Shelbai won a challenger at the start of the year, so he's okay at doubles, although I don't think he's won a doubles match since then. Hassan is a terrible doubles player, like very good singles player, but I didn't see any of that match. I watched their match today. They lost today against Murray and Venus.
Yeah.
And I watched the majority of that, and Hassan was terrible in that. That, to me, I can't get my head around how that result has happened. Hassan, I don't think, has won a doubles match all year before that. That is crazy. And I mean, that sort of situation to me is crazy that they, you know, they won a match. So you can argue that it was justified in that regard. But the fact that, say, Henry and Harry, who are a combined, I think, 91 in the world or something, who've won a 250, won, Harry's been top 10 in the world. They won a 250, final of a 250 in the last 3 weeks, and they can't get in the Masters. But we're allowing two guys who are, I think, 400 combined in singles, not in doubles, who those two guys have chose to not play the Challenger 175s this week in singles to play the doubles in Madrid. Like, to me, that's not what this system is all about. That's
so
not
they,
why
they've got doing. In on the protected singles list, right? Where
there's so many singles players who are allowed to get in, and there weren't many who signed in. They were the last ones, and everybody they signed in. And nobody expected them to get in, but no other singles players signed in. So, and Henry and if there was one less singles pair to come in, then Henry and Harry would have got in. But in the end, they didn't get in. They've had to go and play Challenger this week in doubles, which the ranking points won't make the world a difference to them, instead of playing a Masters. And those guys who really, I can't really get my head around why they didn't go to play the Masters, to play the Challenger at 175. So they would both have gained from that to play doubles instead. And I can only imagine it's just because of the money.
Yeah.
But I mean, other than that, I mean, you know, we keep hearing about, we want to find out this narrative about singles players versus doubles players. I think yesterday it was 6-9. So, 3-9. I think 3 singles players won and 9 doubles players won. And I think today, I don't think any of the singles players have won. I think they've all lost today. Okay. Other than, you can kind of say Jordan Thompson, but Jordan Thompson is just a very good tennis player, singles and doubles. Like, I'm not really having him as a singles player.
Thompson and Korda beating Multani and Piers. I mean,
And Multani and Piers, they're a scratch pair.
I
know that both of them were looking for a partner at the back end of last week. Because I think Multani's usual partner has had a baby. And I think Piers has got a regular partner at the minute. So they were a scratch pair. And like I say, Jordan Thompson is as much of a doubles player as he is a singles player. So I'm not counting those as... And Korda's just got a cannon of a serves.
Speaking of Harry and Henry, and indeed Luke and Skander, they've both ended up at the same challenger this week and both end up in the same half of the draw. And Calvin, you've got your feet up tomorrow or whenever they get in court because you're not allowed to say anything. They are playing each other.
Yeah. I mean, it's mad, really, that I think since I started coaching both Luke and Henry, I think they've been at the same tournament four times and they've played each other first or second round in three of them.
Oh, really?
Well, including tomorrow. Yeah, it's a bit of a rough one. It's a rough one in particular because they're both teams are in very good form. Luke and Skander, just they won a... I mean, he's only 75 challenger last week, but the draw would have comfortably have... I mean, the draw could have been as strong as this tournament, to be fair, the players who they had to beat and the quality they had to beat and the quality of the players in the draw. So they're in good form. Henry and Harry are obviously in good form. So it's a bit of a sinker in that regard. And as well, there's... the rest of the draw isn't the strongest, I don't think. So it's a bit of a shame that they're playing each other first round, especially seeing as both could do with points, like Henry and Harry looking for points to try and move towards getting seeded in US Open, I guess, and the Masters in the States. And Luke and Skander, I think, need to make final this week to guarantee French Open. I think they'll already be alternates, but...
Frustrating. I mean, we've kind of talked about this before when it's happened, but I think, am I right in saying your rule here is you'll give them their own prep, but not talk about the oppo, basically?
Yeah, just that, yeah. I mean, it's a bit, you know, they're both different characters anyway, Luke and Henry. Like, Henry, I tend not to, unless I'm at the tournament, I don't have a pre-match conversation with Henry. He likes to just sort of, I'll message him about other stuff during the day, but we don't have a specific one, and we'll have, in the group, we'll have messaged tactics and that kind of thing. So we've gone over that. I won't necessarily have a pre-match chat with him. Luke likes to have a pre-match chat, which is fine. I'll probably do that tomorrow. But that will just strictly be about his own game. I told them both already today, I always reaffirm it on the day before, that I won't get involved in it. We've obviously got two groups. I'm in a group with Luke and Skander. I'm in a group with Harry and Henry and Harry's coach. And we'll normally discuss, I'll fire in tactics, that kind of thing. We'll all fire in thoughts. But I said to them both, look, you're just going to have to leave me out of it today because I won't get involved in that.
It does make your watching habits a bit easier because you're not on tour this week. You can just concentrate on one match. Although it sounds like with the weather in Aix-en-Provence, God knows when it's going to actually happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, although I think today it's weird because I think they're behind, but they seem to have kept on playing. But I keep getting emails of updates of the schedule for today, so they must have lost some time. And then I know when Luke and Skander were playing yesterday, it was raining pretty heavy against Virtanen and locally. And they kept playing through it, but you could see the rain on the camera coming down pretty heavy. So
crikey. Right, well, thanks for all your questions, as always. If you've got one sitting in the mailbox, I might go and pick it out, but your best chance is to email a different one. tennisunfiltered@gmail.com. Right, let's move on to Emma Raducanu, who lost, I think, only a few hours after we recorded our last podcast. So it may feel like old news to you, but, well, it's Emma Raducanu. She's always new news to us. She was beaten by Maria Lourdes-Carle, who I don't think anyone will give me abuse for saying I had not heard of before. She came in as a lucky loser to play Emma Raducanu in the first round. And she, frankly, pumped her 6-2, 6-2. She'd been in good form, winning a lot of matches in a row on clay, but at nowhere near tour level, realistically. Raducanu said afterwards she was feeling pretty tired. She talked about how brutal the tour is and how she just felt exhausted from a busy 10, 15 days. She looked it on court as well, quite frankly. If we're being totally honest. And she was, I have to say, I was going to go on to our group and say, oh, guys, it's ridiculous. Like, Anne Kyothvong's on commentary for the Raducanu match. Like, how can she possibly be impartial? She's her Billie Jean King Cup captain. Like, Raducanu's just led them to the Billie Jean King Cup finals with two wins in France. Like, she's just going to soft soap it. They should really have some independent pundits on. Ahem. Unfiltered pundits, perhaps, you might suggest. Anyway, credit where credit's due. Anne Kyothvong can come on Tennis Unfiltered anytime she wants because she did not fail to tell it like it is. Her and Colin Fleming did some post-match analysis that some of the more brutal punditry I've seen. She said, with Rome, I don't know what the wildcard situation is there, but maybe in hindsight, it would have been better to take this week off. Should she have used the wildcard in Madrid? It's a number of weeks between now and the first grass court event. It's a long training block. She's already had 8 months on the sideline. She has said and proven she gets confidence from the hours she puts on the practice court. But we talk a lot about head, heart and legs. And if your head and your heart aren't in it, your legs don't stand a chance. It was really disappointing to see. She said she was tired before the match, but do you talk yourself into more tiredness? George, I mean, you know Anki Ottavon quite well as well, and she doesn't necessarily mince her words, but she's often a bit more diplomatic than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not the first time I've seen her skewer there. I don't know if that was a bit harsh. But,
I mean, a lot of people have said a lot worse.
One of her own team, and, you know, Annie's a very kind of straightforward and to the point person in many ways. It's kind of hard to disagree with the analysis, I think, is what I'd say. I don't really necessarily buy the idea she would be that physically tired at this stage of the season and with the amount of matches she's actually had. Certainly doesn't feel out of the ordinary to me. I guess you could say, yeah, she's spent a long time out and maybe you've struggled to kind of get that fitness going, but I don't know. I'm just not that sold that she should be that tired at this stage of the season given the kind of previous results she's been having. You know, it's not like the strictest schedule we've ever seen, and it's not like she's been winning every single match in that schedule that would potentially kind of build into that tiredness. So I think Anne's kind of, you know, within her rights to point that out, really. That mental thing she said is true. I mean, how often do we all go into real life with a kind of slightly negative view and then do a lot worse than you maybe could have done because you kind of went into it feeling crap?
Self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? Yeah. I tell you what, Calvin, I'll let you come in. But I have a bit of sympathy here, which is why I wanted to speak next. I think...
So you're going to be a non-sympathy sandwich. Oh, sorry, a sympathy sandwich, because the filling is the sympathy.
Exactly.
What made you think that I won't be sympathetic?
just a guess.
Just a feeling. Just a feeling. Look, the reason I'm sympathetic is because... And it's there's a number of reasons. Look, it's not a match thing. Like, she played 6 matches in 15 days or something. Not even that. More days than that. I'm trying to do the maths off the top of my head. It's about 13 days, actually, which is like basically like winning a Grand Slam, and certainly is not like what she had to do with the US Open. But I think, and I don't always subscribe to the view that, you know, you see it on social media all the time whenever she loses, people just like, oh, stop doing all the modelling, or people assume because they see her on a billboard that she's done a photo shoot that day. Or that she's there. I don't know if these people just can't really comprehend that it's a picture of her, not actually her standing on a billboard anyway. But the events that she'd been to, Billie Jean King Cup, where you have quite a lot of media, she will have had quite a lot of media obligations she couldn't really say no to. It was also quite an emotional tie. Like, it was quite a up and down tie. She was clearly emotional on court when she won, like, which I think is great to see. Like, we want players to show emotional court, and that was really good. She then had to go to Stuttgart for the Porsche Grand Prix, and obviously Porsche are a major Raducanu sponsor, and she did do quite a lot of filming with them, and I think at least one day, maybe 2 days. Like, that's, again, a bit of a drain, like, when you maybe just want to, you know, you've just got back into the rhythm of playing tennis again, you want to get out and practice, and you've got to go do this, that, and the other, and, you know, the reality is that if you're filming or doing whatever, it does interrupt your practice schedule, however much people say it doesn't. It does, and I know it does. We know it does from court scheduling, getting moved around and turning, you know, etc. And then she goes to Madrid, where she's got a wild card from IMG. And again, if you agree to a wild card, you have obligations. Like, if you're not a seeded player, often you don't have many obligations. But if you're a wild card, like, you've got to, you know, he who pays the piper picks the tunes. And you've got to sing for your supper and all sorts of other metaphors that I could throw in. And so, I'm sure she's not blameless in this, but I do give some credence to the idea that she could have been a bit emotionally drained, and that's kind of something you chalk up to experience. Like, on two levels. One, you've got to learn not to ride the roller coaster. Like, I've spoken to so many players, and it's always boring when I hear them say it, but they're right. When they're like, well, I never get too high or too low because, you know, it's a long year and it happens all the time. You've got to try and maintain that kind of easy level in the middle. And also, just sort your scheduling out. Like realise that when you go to these events, realise the Porsche Grand Prix is going to have some things attached to it. Realise that the Billie Jean King Cup is a quite emotionally draining thing and, you know, you need to learn how that affects you. Realise that wildcards come with a cost attached. And I think, to that extent, she's still young. You know, she's... And I'm not talking really about tennis here. It's just about playing the game off the court. And the reality is that she's we know the situation she's in with her agency and with her management, and like, yeah, she does make a lot of money off the court, but that again comes at a price. And I think there's a pretty big lesson to be learned there, and I don't think it's unreasonable of Anne or Colin or anyone else to come out and say that, Calvin.
I'm struggling to buy the idea that she was tired, though, even taking all that into account, James, because I just don't see how, in the end of the day, look, she barely played this year. She played the Billie Jean King Cup, where she was excellent, and then she played the tournament after that, I forget where it
Stuttgart.
Was. Stuttgart. Stuttgart, where she played very well and put a good performance against Świątek. But I don't get how that tires you out. Like, I just don't understand it. And yeah, there'll be some stuff off the court that she's got to attend to, I'm sure. But you'd rather be doing that than not doing that, because it means that's better than having no money and being skint all the time and trying
and not,
to find
and not
your way
being
around.
On tour.
Yeah, and not and the bit that I found most concerning was the tour is brutal. What's this tour that she's talking about? A Fed Cup match in France, a tournament in Germany, and then a tournament in Italy.
Spain,
sorry. That's brutal, is it? Hmm. I'm going to read now. I've just looked, right? And no, there's, you know, it's marginally not comparable, but it is. Luke's partner, Skander Mansory, has played 45 matches this year. He's not had a week off. Next week is his first week off of the year. Wow. He's done. This has been his schedule. He's done 3 weeks in Thailand, the last week of which they won, and they flew straight back to Belgium, had one day off, which they travelled in, and then had to play a match. They won that tournament. He then went to Dallas for 1 week, came back to the Middle East for 3 weeks. He then played a tournament in Switzerland. He then went to Ghana to play the African Games, which he won at doubles. They then went to Mexico for 4 weeks, made the final, one day rest again to come back and play Rome last week, which they won, and he's currently in France. Now, when you're talking about the tour being brutal, that's the Challenger Tour as well. The hotels are okay, but they're not unbelievable. You're having to scrape, you're having to budget for your meals and that kind of thing. You're flying economy class everywhere in that regard. I just don't get how you can be coming out and saying the tour's brutal. Like the tour that Emma Raducanu has, I can tell you now, is not brutal. Because I've luckily been lucky enough to experience some of the hotels at the tournaments where the tournaments that Emma plays. It's not brutal. You might not enjoy traveling all the time. Like you might want to be at home all the time. But again, there's an argument for saying, you know, that this maybe isn't the job for you then. But in Emma's position at her age, it's not like she's got kids and that kind of thing who, you know, she has to be away from or, you know, that kind of situation. I just don't get for the life of me how, and look, there's nothing, if she's tired, you just, it's a bit frustrating, but you go, got to get fitter. That's fine. Most players go through that stage. Djokovic went through a stage where people were saying he's not fit enough. Murray went through the same stage. I'm sure Federer did, although I can't really remember. Look at what they went on to become. Great things. She could get herself fitter and that kind of thing. I just don't get how you're tired after 5 matches in a 2-week period. I just can't understand it. And then to be going, the tour is brutal. Like, that's not brutal. And then the weird thing is, like, I remember I saw somebody on Twitter, like, sort of defending it, and they were going, oh, you know, it's brutal. She had a journey from London to France and then had to go from France to Germany and then Germany back to Spain. Like, So, like,
it's like an hour and
flight.
A half, yeah.
Like, and again, in the lounge, business, you know, in the VIP lounge, business class, like, what a life. It's a great life. Come on. And you're making a fortune.
I suppose that this isn't so much about the tour, but I suppose from Raducanu's perspective, you could potentially make the argument that, you know, she's someone whose entire life is under the microscope the whole time. She probably can't go anywhere without anyone kind of looking at her. There probably is a degree of kind of being drained in life.
Is it anymore? Is it that? I don't know if it is that anymore, though, George. Like, I don't know if Emma walks down Putney High Street. I don't know if people are, like, spotting her and recognising her straight away anymore. She's quite famous in, like, tennis fans would. Don't think, you know, she's not Taylor Swift. So George, a few years ago, George might have argued she was more famous.
We definitely don't have time for the Instagram argument. I can see it both ways. I guess that there's an element of perspective as well, like, you know, the life that you've been used to, the life you expect, and all those things. And you know, I said it in the thing I wrote last week, Raducanu, and you mentioned it, Calvin, she's never really been on tour. Like, as a junior, she was out a lot. You know, she took time out for her studies because that was important to her. So, yeah, these runs, that's why they sent Andrew Richardson to the States in 2021. Like, he was seen as a really safe and comforting pair of hands. And so I think maybe there is a character thing going on there as well, George.
Yeah.
And also, sorry, George, I'll just nip in there once, right? If this is a problem and she's a tennis player, right, then she's got to be saying to a management agency, look, you need to get me doing less stuff here.
Yeah.
I need to be doing, you know, and I'm not saying, I totally agree with you there, James, where saying people go, no, she needs to be doing less modelling and that kind of thing. That's just bullshit. She's not, don't think she's doing, like, overly any of that. Don't think it's impacting on training and that kind of thing. But if she thinks she's getting tired because of commercial duties, or you know, it could be a case that she's getting paid appearance fees for tournament that she doesn't want to play and that kind of thing, then she needs to go to a management people and go, look, you need to do less. I don't really care about the money. I've already got a lot of money. I'll probably never have to work again anyway, already. So you need to get me doing less. Now, there's a question to be asked whether she wants to do that or whether she quite likes the money.
I mean, I guess there's a kind of potentially a broader question. I'm not saying I've done lots of thinking about this. This is a bit off the cuff. But I would say there's probably been a bit more of a trend through the years of kind of young female athletes in tennis really... they do struggle and burn out quite young compared to a lot of other, you know, compared to the male equivalents. You know, I'm thinking kind of Capriati, Hingis to a degree. Naomi Osaka, probably the modern day example of, you know, that. And actually, you could argue that their trajectory has been relatively similar in terms of kind of huge kind of interest, and maybe find that side of things overwhelming. And, you know, Osaka really stepped back from the game and found that. And obviously, we, you know, wouldn't want to wish that kind of thing on Emma, but it does seem to be a bit more of a trend. Barty retiring at 26, you know, there certainly seems a bit more of a trend in the women's game than the men's, that something is being felt in these sort of scenarios, which, you know, probably is something about, you know, something to consider for the tours, but potentially.
Well, and also for, like, people in the industry, and I mean, like agents. You know, we say a lot of things about agents, and I'm friends with lots of agents, and I'm also not friends with lots of agents, but. There are people out there who understand that side of things and who do say, look, on the one hand, yes, you might blow your knee out tomorrow, so we should cash in on everything that we can make now. But this also might push your mental health over the edge. So let's keep that in mind. Let's, you know, let's book in a monthly check-in. Let's sort out a psychologist who can maybe work with you. You know, there are people out there who acknowledge that side of things better than others.
I mean, my best friend is an agent, and he's a very good agent. And he will say, I know if we had him on the podcast now, and he's done huge deals for the very famous athletes and sports stars, he would say that he's certain, because he makes sure of this, that none of them want to do anything that they don't want. None of them do anything that they don't want to do. He said he always leaves them with, look, this is what's on the table. Do I think it's a good amount? Yes, I think it's a good amount. Or no, I don't think it's a good amount. This is the amount that they're offering. Do you want to do it? And he says if they'll answer it, and he'll never put any pressure on one way or the other. And, you know, I'm going to say that his athletes are all doing pretty well for themselves, and they've all been pretty successful. So I don't know if all agents do that, because he's the only one that I know personally who does. I know a couple others, to be fair, but I don't know their ins and outs. But I know that what my best mate tells me is that, and when we're, if I had this conversation with him, he would always say, look, it rests on the athlete. They don't have to do anything that they don't want to do. And he says that the problem is a lot of them, they don't want to do it, but they like the money.
I wonder as well, with kind of Emma's situation specifically, whether the kind of family involvement on like the coach and not wanting to pay the right amounts and stuff and get that experienced figure in who would kind of maybe have be that stronger voice against some of that commercial stuff, if that is a factor, is kind of missing there. You know, is are the people they're putting in a little bit too kind of yes man to the machine rather than actually necessarily taking the right stage?
Well, Max Eisenblatt knows all the best tennis coaches in the world.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
He knows all 10 of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he could get someone.
Yeah. I'm sure they come cheap when they're the top 10. But anyway, I think there's a lot of dynamics there that maybe are the right voices coming forward to help put her in the best sort of position. But the answer we probably feel is probably not.
Well, look, if and we might get on to talking about Francis Tiafoe today, and he's had a rotten run of form on the court, and he's split with his coach. So, and that is like most players kind of default, playing badly, sack your coach. Football club, playing badly, sack your manager. Well, surely if things are going badly off the court and you find yourself burnt out, you should be looking at whose fault that is. And like, you can't sack yourself. So maybe start, and I'm not saying Emma Raducanu should turn around and sack, you know, IMG and find a new agent. What I'm saying is that if you do think that you are tired, there has to be a reason for that. And you need to scrutinise that. And, you know, she comes from a very business-like background. And they should be looking at that and saying, OK, how has this happened? Why has this happened? Whose fault is it? How can we make it better in the future? Because
I think the most frustrating thing for me with all that was that what we want to see is Emma Raducanu be one of the top tennis players in the world. She brings a whole lot to the game. She's an excellent player. She's a good personality to have around and that kind of thing. So you think in doing that, we need to see her playing tennis. And we've not seen enough of that since the US Open, since she won the US Open, whichever way you look at it. So then we get this situation. She comes back for Billie Jean King Cup, and I don't think many of us really expected too much. Came back, played excellent at Billie Jean King Cup. Then she went straight to Stuttgart, played excellent there. You start thinking, right, okay, this is now what we're talking about. Let's get a run together now. The next tournament, she's going, the tour's brutal. I'm tired. Like, come on.
Yeah. Sad. It's a bit sad, I think.
Is this going to be the way? Is this going to be how it is now? Like, is she really going to be able to play? Is it going to have to be two tournaments, one off?
I don't know. It's the British model, isn't it?
I thought that was one on, two off.
Right, maybe. Let's move on to Rafa Nadal, shall we? Another tired person, lazy.
Yeah, he's been pathetic this week.
he's finally winning some matches, although he was beaten by Jiří Lehečka on Tuesday night. They had a huge. I'm noticing now that when players are retiring, these ceremonies are called like thank you, Rafa. Like, they've all learnt from 2019 Australian Open, like, don't say goodbye. It might not actually be goodbye. You'll make yourselves look like idiots. They unveiled a huge banner, five column-shaped banners in the Manolo Santana Stadium. Although one of the banners didn't unfurl properly, which I thought was quite funny. Rafa said, it's a joke, I'm coming back next year. I hope he didn't mean it. Not because I don't want to come back, just because I just don't need more retirement parties. We've had enough of them. He almost threatened to not play the French Open because he said that if he felt like he did in Barcelona, he wouldn't play it. And still thinks he could play the Olympics, so why would he push himself too much for Roland Garros? I think we all know, George, he's going to be at Roland Garros, isn't he? And you know what? He's starting to look quite good. Don't rule him out.
Well... but I also still don't rule him out withdrawing, to be honest. I think, you know, we've sort of spoken a little bit about where we think he is, and he was quite honest about it, I thought, where he basically said, look, if I don't think I'm winning the French Open, I ain't playing it. And he feels quite far off winning the French Open to me right now. I know he's won a couple of matches this week, but... Is he really going to go and beat Djokovic? I mean, who knows where Djokovic is right now, to be fair, but is he going to beat...
I mean, literally, Sinner. Who knows where Djokovic is?
Who's informed, though? This is an interesting narrative, I think. When you look at it and you go, who's stepping up, and you go, you know, that's going to be a tough way. I mean, we'll get onto it in a minute. Rublev just beat Alcaraz.
Like, I suppose Sinner's the one, isn't he, still, probably?
Yeah, but then Sinner's like... I saw Sinner the other day complaining of some sort of injury or something.
Yeah, he's got a hip problem that he doesn't really know what's going on with, which is a bit worrying. Yeah.
I guess it's more the, is he physically going to go through... Like, it feels to me, if he loses the first set at the minute, Rafa, he ain't winning the match. It feels kind of the vibe, which, you know, suggests maybe he doesn't feel he's got enough to go in the tank. And then if he's only getting three or four matches in to a best of three, is he going to have, you know, seven, potentially three or four set matches in him? Only he kind of knows that. I suspect he will play, but I think it is quite interesting. And the point you're making there, Calvin, probably does play on his mind. You know, he will be running that pretty strong analysis in his own head of, like, it's not just how well I'm... What percentage do I need to be and what percentage do other guys need to be? And you'd probably say the other guys are down somewhere at 70, 80 at the minute. He's probably somewhere 50, 60, but his 50, 60 is pretty bloody good on clay still. Mm. So he'll... Yeah.
There's 4 weeks to go until he'd have to play his first match as well.
Yeah.
Don't forget that. That's a long time. If you're trying to get just physically fit, like just some air in the lungs, plenty of time. Yeah. Plenty of time. If he doesn't have any kind of niggles or injuries, plenty of time.
And interestingly, I mean, I know Madrid isn't always a great indicator for Roland Garros, but it, you know, it's still clay and Rafa's won it 5 times. Like, you know, of the top 10 players in the race, only 3 of them, as we speak, are left in the tournament. Hurkacz went out in the last 16. Dimitrov, Dimonor, Tsitsipas, all out in the second round. Alcaraz, as we said, just lost to Rublev. Zverev out. Ruud lost to Auger Aliassime, which I think isn't... Irrespective of how good Auger Aliassime may or may not be, I think we all know that's a terrible defeat for a guy who's been French Open final twice in a row. Like, you're right. Like, who is in form? Who do you look at and go, oh, okay, yeah, maybe they could be a threat? Like, I really don't think there are many guys on clay right now. You know, where's Holger Rune been for the last 2 months? It's just... There's a lot of players out there.
18 months.
Well, yeah, quite. And I just wonder. Like, I don't think Nadal's going to win it, but it wouldn't surprise me if he gets to the quarters.
I don't know. But then if... I agree with what you're saying, James. But then if it gets to the quarters...
Oh, then I'm just throwing all my money on
him. Who are you fancying to beat him there? Say he gets to the quarters and he's got Ruud or Rune or Dimitrov or even Medvedev. Like, yeah. Rublev. Are you backing any of them when you think, well, he's got 5 matches in him at this stage?
This all just feels like such a mental time for Novak to be ducking out mentally as well, isn't it? Like, he should be walking like this on paper to some degree, like at the French, you know.
Yeah, they probably should be giving him the trophy on the door. Like, he just has to get to the door. News this week that he has parted ways with another member of his team, this time his long-term fitness coach, Marco, and he's back with one of his previous long-term fitness coaches, I'm told, according to Sasha. So that now is both of his media people, his coach and his fitness coach, all gone in the last 4 or 5 months. He obviously skipped Miami, he skipped Madrid. We assume, I mean, he's on the list to play Rome. Maybe he'll have pulled out by the time. You'd think if he's going to play the French Open, he's got to play Rome, right? Like,
yeah. He's been posting training videos and stuff, hasn't he? He certainly does seem like he is preparing to play. Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder who's going to be this year's Cecchinato who randomly takes him out in some sort of...
What do you think? Maybe this is just Djokovic now, Kat? I mean, I know we think he's in the middle of a wobble, but... I do wonder whether maybe the final stages of Djokovic's career are just going to be him playing, like, and I mean like 8 tournaments a year and then a few exos and maybe Davis Cup if he feels like it.
No, I think he'll play definitely play all the slams. He'll play one of the grass court tournaments before that. Imagine he plays a couple of hard court tournaments before the US Open, and yeah, maybe you're right. But I think it'd be more than 8, but and as well, like I've said for a while, this is not peak Djokovic. I mean, he's in the end game now. You know, it's might be around for another 2 or 3 years, but this is not the guy who comes in and just destroys everybody on anything. Like, I think, you know, I'm still making favourite for Wimbledon ish, but I don't know. Don't know if I do. He's got if he doesn't do anything in Rome or French Open, are we still making him favourite for Wimbledon? going to be a long while since he's won a big tournament then.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I think we might as well talk about it. Alcaraz was beaten by Andre Rublev today, and I think it's very significant that it was with a closed roof in Madrid because it's been pissing with rain. And I think, okay, Rublev maybe not the guy I would have picked, although he's playing very well. Like, he's got rid of some decent players on clay this week. Like,
is he though? He's been in terrible form up until this week, though.
Well, yeah, he's barely won a match for like 3 months, basically since that DQ in the Middle East. But all of a sudden, found a bit, and then like Alcaraz indoors, I think we know is definitely like his weakest surface. Like, without that kind of pop, I mean, Alcaraz's serve, by the way, like Tennis Insight stats have been flying around everywhere this week. Alcaraz has got like one of the worst serves, I think, in like the top 40. Like, statistically, like, it must be amazing for a coach. I mean, Calvin, you would look at a player like him and go, bloody hell. I mean, there's some area for improvement here. He's already this good and he's got an awful serve. Like, this guy's only just getting started, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's got a great serve. I don't think he's got an awful serve by any stretch. I don't think he's served well this year. But his serve is definitely the weakest area.
And he's had a forearm injury, which probably doesn't help.
Yeah. I think what he's good at is ball three, which is, you know, if you can be good at ball three, that's the greatest masker of an average serve.
Right.
But I think it's always, but that's always been the case. I'm not sure we'll ever see him have a great serve, to be honest, because I think at every level that he's been at, he's never had what you would call a great serve. And that tends to be the case of, you know, that the great servers at, you know, like say Cilic, for example. Remember Cilic, when Cilic was 14, he had a great serve. So, and it just kind of goes up through the age groups, whereas Alcaraz never really had a great serve. So I think his serve will get better, but I don't think we'll ever see him even like being as good as Djokovic was with serve, or Federer or Nadal even.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, Calvin, is at what stage did presumably Djokovic's serve was never kind of that amazing at junior level or whatever, or what age did that kind of properly change?
Well, that
change
came very late, but what interesting with Djokovic, what changed was he just got very, very accurate. It didn't improve in terms of pace or anything necessarily so much, I don't think, but he just got phenomenally accurate at it, and being able to hit spots in big moments with first and second serves and make a lot of first serves to spots, and that will do you a lot of good if you can do that. Now, that was exceptional stuff from Djokovic to do that. We'll see if Alcaraz does end up doing that. I don't know, but I think he's already pretty accurate though. Like, and as well with Djokovic, I think Djokovic in around sort of 2008-ish, I think his serve was bad. Like, I remember him playing Murray and he was just throwing, I think he played Murray in the final of either Indian Wells or Miami, and he was just throwing double faults in all over the shop. Like, it was just a bad serve, and he managed to make a bad serve into a good one. Whereas I don't think Alcaraz's serve is bad. I just think it's pretty average for a top 100 player. I think he probably falls somewhere in the middle of it. But yeah, it's interesting with Rublev, isn't it? Because he's a bit of an enigma, because the thing what we always, like the stick that we used to beat him most of the time is that, you know, he just doesn't have it again. He's great at beating the guys outside of the top eight, top seven or eight, but he doesn't have it against those. And it's fair, but he's also now beaten them all.
Yeah.
Like you know, so...
And now can't beat everyone outside the top eight. He could do both at once.
You know, he's one of the few who, I think, this was the final one today, he's beaten Federer, Nadal, Djokovic,
Murray.
I mean, I guess he beat... It didn't really beat
post-Murray.
Murray.
But,
yeah.
But for the stats...
Has he beaten Medvedev? Has he beaten Medvedev?
What a great question. You would assume... I mean, he's got a bad head-to-head with him, hasn't he? But
I mean, they're best mates, aren't they? So.
Yeah, he beat him Tour Finals 2022. There you go.
Right, okay, fair enough, yeah. So he has beaten them all. Mm. But again, big tournaments. Do you back him to beat any of them? Like, if he gets to a semi... I think he tends to be good at beating them before that. If he gets to a semi, do you back him to beat any of them?
Well, he's got to get to a semi. Like, I mean, he's got that horrific quarterfinal record. Yeah. Which I guess, like, is also, we always talk about it. You don't want to be, like, if you're seeded 5-8, your quarterfinal is always going to be one of the big guys.
Yeah.
Like, and he's been in that 5-8 bracket for quite a number of years.
Yeah.
probably, I would say, at least 2.5 seasons, he's been ranked between 5 and 8. So he's just always ended up with those quarterfinals. So, like, that quarterfinal record, I don't think is, like, emblematic of him being a bottle job. I think it's more a symptom of just his ranking and the way that the draws are rigged. People always ask me if the draws in tennis are rigged. They are. You should see how rigged they are. Like, they have 32 players who get to avoid each other in the first two rounds. It's unbelievable. And then you should see how they're rigged within that. But they don't call it rigging. They call it seeding. Anyway, that's just my personal bugbear. Unseeded draws all round, I say. Right, let's move on. There's lots of little bits and pieces, some of which are going to expire. We could talk about Mira Andreeva, but given that she's currently playing on TV in front of me against Aryna Sabalenka, I think I'm going to avoid it.
Kind of Pedro's share, don't we? That's been the fun
I think it's time to
week.
Talk about Pedro Caccini, because I also have a sporting endeavour to get away to tonight, George. So
yeah.
If we don't talk about it now, we never will. Right. Pedro Caccini played Rafael Nadal. His hero for his whole life. And having lost to him, asked at the net if he could have his shirt. Your points of view may be not necessarily relevant, but we will talk about them. David Law tweeted, "Sorry, Pedro, asking for your opponent's shirt at the net ain't it." Nick Kyrgios abused him. A bloke who I haven't heard of since he played like the sort of hot professor's son in Heroes about 15 years ago, also like, called him David Law a tool, which was a bit uncalled for, and also like a very weird sort of two worlds meeting. Nick Kyrgios said, "Why NBA players and soccer players do it all the time. It's a memory, an experience that took a lifetime of work, and that less than 1% of humans get to do. You wouldn't understand." Now, Kyrgios has pissed me off there by saying the classic thing, "You weren't a tennis player, how could you possibly know or have an opinion?" Yeah, I mean, I suspect, I don't know. Lads, your opinions on Pedro Caccini asking for a shirt at the net?
Do you want me to go, George, or are you going?
Yeah, you dive in, Calvin, and I'll dive so.
I don't have a problem with it. I can understand the argument why some people think he shouldn't have. I don't think it was pre-planned. I think he asked for it at the end. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think the issue was he asked for it. He didn't make a big song and dance about it. He asked for it in Spanish. And then I think it was only because Nadal went and gave him it and on the bench.
And then dubbed him in and then said afterwards all he asked for it.
Yeah, I think if they'd have just waited for the locker room, I don't blame Nadal for that. He probably wasn't thinking or anything. That's fine. I don't think there'd been any, you know, how do we know it's not happened before? Mm. How do we know another, you know, somebody hasn't asked somebody? But, you know, from Caccini's point of view, like, he's just playing at a great match with the greatest clay court player of all time, his hero. And you'd think it, you know, I think it's fine for him to ask for the shirt. I really do. I don't think it harms anybody. I had some people, I commented it on Twitter last night, I had some people going, "The fans don't want to see this." Like, imagine how precious you'd have to be to take offense to it.
In fairness, and tennis fans are fucking precious.
Very, very. from David Law's point of view, he has a right to his opinion. I think it's a legitimate opinion. If he doesn't think it's, you know, that's fine. I don't. My issue that I took with that was I don't think he just. I think he made a snide comment to somebody who he thought it was all right to make a snide comment about. I don't think he'd have made that about all players. I don't think if a player who he has a relationship with, like, not, I say relationship, like if he knows them and speaks to them regularly, I don't think, for example, if Jack Draper would have asked for it, I don't think he'd have made such a snide comment. I think he's jumped on a little bandwagon, and I think this is, unconsciously, it's now become a bit of a. It's become easy to have a bit of a dig at Pedro Caccini just because Sasha Bublik made. And I do think when Bublik made it, it was a pretty throwaway comment. I don't think he was meaning that Caccini was shit by any stretch. He was taking the piss out of Casper Ruud's run to the U.S. Open final, and I think it could have been any one of 50 players who he mentioned.
Yeah.
But I just kind of think it's become okay to just like stick the boot in at certain players. And that's what I thought was snide about what David Law's comment was. I didn't think it was on. I also didn't think, I mean, I'm loath to defend Kyrgios, but I don't think that was abuse, what Kyrgios said. It was a bit daft him saying that, like you say, James, that like you don't even, he thinks that nobody who hasn't played in a Wimbledon final can say anything, but you know. I might also say that I don't, unless you won a Wimbledon semi-final, I don't think you can claim to be a Wimbledon finalist either. But I don't think it was abuse. I mean, the other guy, the actor, I don't even know who he is, to be honest. But, you know. But,
I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you his name, but I did recognise his face. He's a good-looking lad.
It's a weird one for abuse this week. So on the same week that we've had, like, Marcus Rashford claiming to have abuse, where basically it's just people saying they wish he'd play better football most of the time. It's not abuse. And I don't think what David Law got was abuse either. But, like I say, I think he made a comment of someone that he thought it was all right to have a dig at.
George, shirt swapping, yay or nay?
I think most typically when you get annoyed about shirt swapping is during the actual event, isn't it?
Like, half-time in the football, yeah.
You know, that's when Roy Keane gets blamed. And I sort of can see that a bit more from the perspective of, you know, if the match is actually still ongoing and you're thinking, God, I've got to get his shirt at half-time, are you kind of fully in the right headspace? Probably not. But you couldn't really fault Kashin's performance, could you? I mean, I thought he played a bloody good match, considering he was a bloke who'd lost 17 matches going into this tournament. To get to third round and give Rafa a pretty good run for his money on clay, okay, not his favourite clay court, but, you know, I think you couldn't really look at Kashin and think, God, he was just having his eye on that shirt the whole time. So
you could see his heart wasn't in it, yeah.
So probably a bit harsh. I mean, I kind of don't get the shirt swapping so much from a tennis player perspective. Like, I think there's something about like a football shirt swap that's got their name on the back, and that's a bit more kind of, you know, oh cool, this is
a bit memorabilia. Like, nah, I'm sorry, you're wrong, George. Like, this is a null. I'm just interrupting because it's like,
well,
a null.
Is he
going to
get him to sign it in the locker room?
Well, yeah, I mean, if he is, like, why not just wait until after?
Do it in the locker room, yeah.
But he might have done that.
He might have done it. Yeah,
he might have expected that. I don't think he expected Nadal to go and, like, you know, just go and get a shirt and give it to him straight away. But
yeah, can you imagine if he'd been like, no, not now, mate. Please, not now. Keep it. Honestly, I'll give it to someone in the crowd.
Do you reckon any of them have done it before? Like, kind of Novak, Roger, Rafa, like, when they were growing up, meeting kind of people they were interested in? Or do you think they're just always wild?
I think Federer did it with Sampras. I mean, I cannot imagine.
It wouldn't surprise me if they have some of each other's shirts now, just from like big matches, that kind of thing. Why wouldn't you? I mean, look, Kashin probably, like, he's one who's laughing. He's got Nadal's shirt from his last match ever in Madrid, probably, or his last winner, his last win ever in Madrid.
I mean, that would be a good turn to the story, wouldn't it, if that ended up on eBay?
That'd be hilarious. Somebody for about a million ago.
That would really shove it down everyone else's throat because she's picking up a million quid or whatever off some random Bitcoin
also,
investor.
Let's face it, George, be pretty good for the headline writers.
Yeah.
Cashing in.
Very good.
Be easy. Too easy. Yeah, I mean, proper storm in a teacup stuff, but this is tennis unfiltered and this is tennis. Like, if you can't have storms in teacups, then what's the point? Other things that are on our order of play, Mira Andreeva has made it as far as the Madrid Open quarterfinals, but as I say, she's currently playing. Felix Auger-Aliassime is actually winning some matches, which I think is more of an indication of Casper Ruud's slump than anything else. And Francis Tiafoe is having a dreadful year. I wanted to bring up, just because Jim Courier said something about it, although I'm keen to finish shortly, he said, confidence is king, right? And if you take your eye off the ball for a second and you lose some matches, you become vulnerable in the eye of the locker room. I think that's a little bit of the story right now, is that players feel like it's an opportunity when they play Francis rather than a huge hurdle. I always think Jim Courier is right, obviously. But it did feel like quite an astute thing to say, because when you think about the great days of Francis Tiafoe, like, you did kind of see people shrink in the face of it. You know, when his big wins in New York and stuff, and he's bouncing off the walls and, he, you know, his stuff's everywhere on his bench, and, like, you just didn't feel like you could beat him. And you know, he just hits every winner and cleans every line. And then now, like, you know, you see him have a couple of bad results and you're like, oh, actually, we can get stuck into this guy. And it's dreadful for tennis, but it'd be really interesting to see how he copes with it, I think. That's my comeback in 6 months and see where he is. Like, let's see what he does, you know. Let's see what he does at US Open next time around.
Yeah, so and we've spoken about him a lot before, haven't we, in the sense of he's someone we all really want to kind of make it because he does have that star quality. I just think there are too many of these runs, aren't there, really, where he just really dips for him. He doesn't ever feel like he's building amazing momentum. He's probably going to have a career where he has a couple of really good slams and a lot of very bad ones is probably where I think he's going to in a land, which maybe isn't that big a surprise with his game style, but it would be so good if he could just be a bit more consistent and there deep in tournaments every week. I think he's someone for the next generation would really draw people in. So, yeah, hopefully he gets it right.
Yes, I agree. Sorry if I'm slightly distracted. My dog's been to the vet today and he hates going to the vet, so they gave him some meds to chill him out. And he's currently lying on the sofa, stoned out of his box, just like mouth half open, staring into space. It's actually quite disturbing, but he's still breathing, so I assume that's basically fine. Right, well, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Best of luck to you tomorrow, whenever it comes around, Calvin. Hope you win. Feel like you might. But yeah, good luck to everyone out there in the south of France. Whoever gets through, as long as they win the tournament, I don't think we'll mind. Please do keep your ratings, reviews and emails coming in. We love having the questions. It makes our episodes much longer, but that's good for you and good for us. But most importantly, please come back next week.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. Podcast Network.